Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Colleton.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Colleton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, we talked about gold and silver price surges in recent weeks, but one that might hit you a lot harder is a cocoa one that has affected world chocolate sales. The American government shutdown is the longest one in history. We go stateside to find out what this all means for the biggest economy in the world. Plus, have we reached peak Ireland? We talked to an author of a controversial new paper from a leading think tank in the UK. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan A's Cullerton. Now, first up, I want to say a huge thank you to Mandy Johnston for filling in for me last week while I was off. I was actually in the US and Canada on a holiday with my mother. So a big thank you to Mandy. I really appreciate that. And this week, we saw the release of the Future 40 report, and it sets out the long-term economic and fiscal outlook for Ireland up to 2065. And as I was looking through it, there was a term in there on page 137 that I thought might be good as an explainer this week. If you want to go and look for it, it's called slobalisation. Yes, you heard that correctly. Slobalisation. This is what they describe as the stagnating importance of international goods trade to the global economy. But really what that means is countries focusing less on importing and exporting, because that's called globalisation, and more on buying from their own country, or else slowing down trade through tariffs or red tape. Now, I picked out this point because the trend of slobalisation can give way to deglobalisation, and that was highlighted as a particular challenge to the future of Ireland's economy. Now, so what would you do if our government decided to shut down over a budget? Well, I was in the States last week and saw what it could look like up close and personal. And to delve into this, joining me now is Ian Hodgson, who is a data reporter for the Financial Times and is based in Washington. So Ian, Republicans and Democrats, they couldn't get the 60 votes to pass a bill funding government services past the 1st of October when the previous federal budget expired. Where do both sides stand on this and what is the problem?
So it's a good question. You know, Democrats are holding out for Republicans to come to the table on cuts that have been made to the Affordable Care Act, which lowers the cost of healthcare for Americans who buy healthcare through a marketplace who don't have insurance through their work. Republicans, on the other hand, are saying that this is an issue that needs to be dealt separately from the budget, and are holding fast that they want a clean budget passed. They don't want to deal on ACA right now. And the two sides are just deadlocked. I mean, both sides think that their supporters support them on these issues. You know, you look at polling across the country, a slight majority of Americans blame Trump and the Republicans for the shutdown. But really, when you know both sides are really dug in, thinking that their supporters support them on their side of the issue,
and therefore, isn't the corollary of that that both sides feel that if they give in, they are doing a disservice to the people who are supporting them in this case?
That's exactly right. And you know, we've seen polling that frustration among Democrats with their own party is through the roof. I mean, up to sort of two-thirds of Democrats say they're frustrated with the Democratic Party, and the biggest issue is they feel like Democrats aren't pushing back enough against Trump. So, you know, this is the issue where Democrats really have felt, okay, we're doubling down. This is the issue that we're sticking our you know, feet in the dirt and we're really pushing back against the Trump administration.
So if we were to take that to its next natural conclusion, then the Democratic Party actually has no incentive whatsoever to break the deadlock, even more so than the Republicans.
That may be the case, but I mean, we're going to start seeing real pain hitting the country. We've already seen SNAP benefits have been reduced. I mean, it's still not clear exactly how much people are going to be paid. SNAP benefits are well, food subsidy that lower income households receive.
Well, okay. And 41 million people in receipt of them. I mean, just for anybody who isn't familiar with SNAP, it's the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. And of course, there was funding cut for that in the Big Beautiful Bill as well. So what happens then? Those 41 million people in America today, among those with most poverty and in most need, what happens then? Because, and by the way, my question is twofold. What happens them this month, but what happens them next month if this deadlock isn't broken?
That's a really good question. So the courts have decided that the Department of Agriculture needs to dip into some reserve funding they have to fund SNAP benefits over the next month. It's not even clear right now how much of the money that households, you know, of the amount that they would normally receive, how much they're going to get this next month. And that funding probably runs out by the end of this month. So if this shutdown stretches into December, those SNAP benefits could go away completely.
It's hard to imagine we're talking about America when we talk about this. But so we're saying that possibly up to Thanksgiving in the US, that maybe there's a very stark Christmas facing 41 million people, should things not change.
Yeah. And, you know, the other place where we're going to start seeing pain is, flight travel. The Trump administration has already announced that they're going to cut about 10% of flights out of the nation's 40 largest airports. And, you know, we're coming up pretty close to Thanksgiving, which is the biggest travel day here in the U.S. And if people are going to start seeing their flights closed or flights canceled, you know, that was a pinch point that really, really closed the 2018-2019 shutdown, which was until now the longest shutdown in U.S. history. When people really started seeing their flights being canceled, delayed times on flights tick up, that put the pressure on Congress to end that shutdown.
Well, when I was in the U.S. last week, I was in Maryland and Virginia. Both states are very close to D.C., where you are yourself. And I was struck by the difference between hearing about government shutdown and federal and millions and billions and things like that, and conversations that were being had around the dinner table, where I was talking to people. And for example, one person exactly said what you've just said, which is, when are you going to be flying home? And are you sure you'll be going given the air traffic control? Another person said she'd been furloughed and she didn't know if or when she might get paid. Another person was talking about how much her health insurance was going to go up at the turn of the month. Like, looking beyond the air traffic control, where do you see the impact of this, and SNAP, obviously, because we've referred to that, where do you see the impact of this really hitting real America?
Well, that's a good question, because, we have, you know, what, 280,000 federal civilian workers here in D.C. There's about 750,000 federal workers across the country that have been furloughed. That's a lot of people, but, you know, relatively speaking, it's a smaller share of the U.S. population. So, where the shutdown, where real pressure to end the shutdown hits is really where it does hit the sort of common American person, which is going to be through SNAP benefits. It's going to be through flights. Those are really the pinch points that are going to end the shutdown.
Well, if I take your own neighborhood as well, as I was walking through the Smithsonian, my mother loves gardens, and we said, oh, we should go over there to the public garden. That was shut down. I want to go to the American Museum of Modern History. That was shut down. Traffic around DC, I was really struck down by the Capitol around about 3 p.m. on a Wednesday when we were there. Very few people around. So is it hyper-focused as well in your own backyard?
Yeah, I mean, D.C. is going to be the D.C. metro area, which you mentioned includes Maryland and Virginia, are going to be the hardest hit. I think, you know, during the last shutdown, there was an estimated cost of about, I think it was about $100 billion lost in the D.C. metro area. You know, across the country, there are estimates that this shutdown is going to cost the economy about $7 to $14 billion. And you also have to keep in mind that DC is a region that's already been hit by sort of wave after wave of economic hits. I mean, the COVID pandemic really hit DC. The work from home hit local businesses, as you know, federal workers were staying at home, not coming into the DC area. Trump's Trump's cuts to the DC workforce and cuts to funding for the sort of nonprofit ecosystem that makes up a lot of the DC economy. It's just been hit after hit after hit that the DC region has had to survive.
Okay, so let's look at how this might stop, right? I think it's, first of all, it's important to really understand what makes this one different. You referred to previous shutdowns and I took a look into that. So Reagan had 8 of them during his period in government. Clinton had a 21-day shutdown in 1995. Obama had a 16-day one in 2013. This one is the longest in history since last Wednesday. What's different about this one?
So I think the biggest difference that we're facing right now might be Democrats are not just having to negotiate a shutdown with Republicans in the House and Senate. They're having to negotiate this with the president, who is really, you know, the guiding force of the Republican Party right now. And throughout the shutdown, we've seen, you know, Trump has been on, I think, 2 international trips. He's been down at Mar-a-Lago most weekends. Whereas in previous shutdowns, you know, the president is here in D.C. trying to get a deal done. The sense I get from colleagues who have talked about the shutdown with lawmakers is they're really waiting for Trump to come to the table and make a deal.
Okay, so over the past couple of weeks, we've seen him in Japan, we've seen him in Korea, we've seen him in China when he spoke about the meeting that was 12 out of 10. So you're saying that part of this is because when you talk about Trump coming to the table, you mean physically getting into a room with people?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the case. I mean, Republican lawmakers, you know, when you talk to them, they've said, look, we've put clean funding bills on the table, voted them again and again, and haven't gotten Democrats over to our side. We're not willing to make a concession. It's probably going to have to be Donald Trump coming to the table with Democrats before those concessions can start to be made.
But Trump has also spoken about nuking the filibit. What's your take on that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, maybe will we start off? Do you want to explain what that means in the first context?
Right. So in the Senate, you need 60 votes out of 100 to pass most legislation. That's called the filibuster. It's a longstanding tradition in the Senate. And the idea is the Senate is sort of the place where U.S. law goes to sort of cool down a little bit. The process is intentionally slower and intentionally built to build more consensus. Republicans don't hold enough seats to pass that filibuster without some Democrats coming over to their side. There have, you know, long been calls to eliminate the filibuster. It sounds like leaders on both sides are not willing to end the filibuster over this shutdown, despite Trump's calls to end it.
But if we look at precedent here, if we go back to Harry Reid and the last time that was done, isn't it, if it is nuked for this situation, should the reins of power change, the filibuster then, or nuking it, enables the other person to basically, or not person, party, people in power, to gain revenge?
Right. I mean, and that's one of the incentives to keep it in place. I mean, any erosion of power that the minority holds, you know, again, kicks you next time you're in the minority.
Okay, so let's now say we understand that the reason possibly that it's there is because there, people are really digging in from the Democratic side. Trump isn't basically around an awful lot. What could break this? What is the incentive to get in place, apart from the obvious one, which is to take care of the people who put them there in the first place? But that incentive is there and they are being shut down. So what do you think needs to happen in order for this problem to go away, to get the food stamps flowing, to get those taxes, or the grants or the tax relief for the health insurance, for all of those benefits to actually happen? What do you think needs to break?
That's a good question. And I wish I had a good answer for you. I think it's really going to be either Democrats back down on their demands for ACA to be restored.
Which is unlikely.
Yeah. Or Republicans come to the table and say, okay, we're going to throw ACA back into the budget and restore that funding, which, you know, at this point also seems unlikely. I mean, like I said before, both parties are really convinced that their base support their positions. And until an erosion happens on one side or the other, both are going to remain dug in.
Right. And then I just want to talk about one last unintended consequence. I was reading a piece that you wrote this week in the FT, and you were referring to private sector job growth in the US. But then you qualified the number by saying, but according to unofficial data from investors, or unofficial data that investors are relying on due to the record government shutdown. Am I right in thinking, Ian, that the people making macroeconomic decisions affecting hundreds of millions of people are basically flying blind without data that is official?
Right. This is one of the biggest issues, at least in the sort of the world that I pay attention to the most, is both investors, policymakers, economists all rely on official federal data, like, you know, the number of jobs, inflation, GDP, to make decisions for the country going forward. I mean, we just had our national Federal Reserve made a decision on cutting interest rates in a period where they don't really know where the job market is going. So they're having to rely on private data, which is helpful, but it is not the gold standard of the federal data that they're used to having in their back pocket when they come into the table to make these decisions.
It's incredibly historic times, and it's one we'll be watching all the way through. Thanks so much indeed for joining me, Ian Hodgson, who is a data reporter for the Financial Times and is based in Washington. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of the global chocolate supply. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now it's time for our trivia this week. Now, as you know, I told you I was away last week, and I'm going to give you three clues about one place my mum and I visited. This was the first ever city incorporated in Canada. It has reversing rapids where the river flows backwards due to the world's highest tides. And now this is the giveaway one. It's named after a river that shares its name with the producer of this show and presenter of Screen Time. What is that city? I will give you the answer at the end of the show. And by the way, I'd say said presenter and producer is really wondering about this one. Well, I have to tell you that Butler's Chocolate is tantalisingly close to News Talk Studios, and my colleague Aoife Breen and I take turns in buying treats for each other from there. However, have you noticed the price of your favourite bar of chocolate rising? And what's behind it? Well, it has to do with the price of cocoa, the raw ingredient of chocolate. And joining me now is Dr. Christy Leslie, founder and CEO of African Cocoa Marketplace. So, Dr. Christy, in New York, cocoa traded this week at round about $6,150 a tonne, down about 50% since its December peak. And in London, prices have almost tripled in the opening months of the year, and they're now down about 58% from their April 2024 peak. What's driving the volatility?
Well, that is a great question. Cocoa is obviously, it's a seasonal crop, right? So we're in the main harvest now in West Africa. So the cocoa is coming off the trees, it's moving to the ports, and it will continue to do so for the next couple of months. So this time of year always introduces, you know, some movement either way, because we know what's happening with the crop. Up until the main harvest starts, it's predictions only, and you can make some really good guesses based on what the weather is doing in West Africa, based on pod counts, you know, counting how many cocoa pods are on the trees, what happens during the minor crop, which happens more in the summer months. But now we know. And what we're seeing now is a pretty healthy supply compared to the past 3 years. And so some of the price volatility is coming from the fact that we know the supply is stronger now than it certainly has been for the past few years. And that is it's put some pressure on the price.
So is this down to, I'm simplifying it, but simple economics, which is greater amount of supply simply then pushes the price down. But the opposite happened before that, which is there was less supply. And that led then, of course, to speculation that less would get lesser, and that pushed up the price. Is that it?
There's, fundamentally that, you know, those are the biggest drivers. Where is supply? Where is demand? And so, you know, I think this is, we always have to start from that that foundation. And as you say, the past few years, we really have seen a really constrained supply. The supply has not met global demand. We have been in a shortage. And so overall, I would say that, you know, it is a supply demand scenario. However, there are always complicating factors. There's the regulatory environment, which can make people skittish or, you know, comfortable. There's, you know, there's demand, and the demand for chocolate has been pretty stable or growing over time. But in the past year or so, we have seen demand changing in ways that have been new.
And what way has demand been changing?
So, you know, honestly, for a very long time, you know, chocolate, the demand for chocolate was pretty inelastic. No matter how much the price changed, people still continue to buy chocolate. It's the kind of everyday treat that people were unwilling to give up. But that has been not the case in the past, you know, months or let's say year. We've seen demand start to fall in response, no doubt, to the price rises that we've seen across the chocolate industry.
I must pass that information on to Aoife Breen and let her know that we can't be letting that happen. But if we just go to the Southern Hemisphere for the moment, you're joining me today from Johannesburg, but in the Ivory Coast and Ghana, if we take those two together, they produce about 2/3 of the world's cocoa, and both governments there put a guaranteed rate in place over the years. How has that affected supply in the region and how much farmers actually get paid?
So absolutely. So, you know, Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana are the world's top two producers, and both of them are highly regulated markets that do set what's called a producer price, and that is a price that's in effect for the whole season and across the country, which is very unusual. Normally, you would see a commodity price change, an agricultural commodity price change across the season. So I think it is an unusual situation. The regulation, the regulatory environment in both countries has positives and negatives. On the one hand, you know, setting the producer price introduces some knowledge and stability into the market. Farmers know how much they're going to get paid for the whole season. They can budget, they can plan based around that. On the other hand, the price is, compared to what farmers earn in other parts of the cocoa growing world, extremely low. And when you come right down to it, that creates a cash flow problem within the system in both countries. And so we can talk about weather, we can talk about tree health, we can talk about you know, anything really, when it comes to what's governing how much cocoa is coming off those trees. But then we also have to remember that if the farmers don't have enough cash in hand, that can really put bottlenecks into the system.
But of course, as well, if they know they're going to get that price, the incentive is there then to invest, isn't there? Because, I mean, both regions are very poor.
Absolutely. You know, and I have never met a cocoa farmer in my 21 years in working in this industry that has not wanted to reinvest in their cocoa farm, who hasn't wanted to make improvements. And, you know, farmers, you know, are very skilled. They're the ones with these trees every day. They know exactly what needs to go into a farm to optimize what's coming out of the farm. And it can be extremely difficult, even from an emotional perspective, to not have the cash to do that.
Well, I just want to ask as well whether something is on the radar. The EUDR, it's the regulation that the EU proposed and has since delayed, requiring companies to buy commodities such as cocoa, but to prove that they don't originate from deforested areas. And obviously, if the cocoa is smuggled, then there wouldn't be the certification accordingly. Is that on the radar of the people that you're talking to?
It really depends what kind of level we're talking about. You know, the farmers themselves, at least the ones I have met, but there have been pockets of better communication strategy, I would say, across the West African region. But certainly the farmers that I would be talking to, you know, that my team are talking to, the EUDR is not part of their everyday conversation. Where it is part of everyday conversation is at the national level, and certainly at the level of the NGO service providers who end up doing quite a bit of the work on mapping the farms, you know, to ensure the traceability that EUDR requires. But I would say in my experience, and again, I don't know every cocoa farmer in Africa, but in my experience that, you know, that this, it's not really what farmers are thinking about every day.
But it's interesting, the reaction to it, because those who are thinking about it, of course, it has now been put off because the EU was saying that the IT systems in order to run the certification and so on aren't there. So therefore, does it incentivize the laggards? Does it disincentivize those who are ready for it?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, we have been on such a roller coaster with this regulation that I would say where we are now, my understanding is that it has been weakened from where we started out. And I think the initial outline of the regulation required an enormous investment in data collection and to farm level. Every single cocoa farm had to be mapped, you know, and we're talking about like millions of farms. That's a massive investment. Now that they are kind of tweaking the traceability requirements to say, you know, not every single person has to have a due diligence statement in the supply chain. You can kind of batch together regions and kind of say they're all sort of, you know, part of one deforestation-free area. I think that it could very well be disincentivizing people to make the investment that they thought they were going to have to make.
And so bringing it closer to home then, if we look at the decline in the price after the rocketing of the price, I'm wondering about the time lag between when we see something like cocoa falling on a wholesale market in London or in New York. Like in the Netherlands, an average 100 gram bar of chocolate cost 35% more this September in comparison to the year before. Mm. And when I look at an Irish company, now most of its market is in the UK, but an Irish company, Lear Chocolates, have said that their pre-tax profit has fallen by 85% as a result of the rocketing price. How long does it take the developments that we have seen in recent days to translate into how much I might spend on chocolate today in a shop?
Another really good question. I think we've been in an inflationary environment, and I think that's always what retailers like. I think it's what, you know, consumer facing brands like, because they can put the price up, and everyone kind of understands why, because the price of everything is going up. And once that price is up, it is really rare for it to come back down. And so even though the price of cocoa is falling, you know, I would be very surprised if we saw a dramatic, you know, an equally dramatic fall in the price of chocolate. I think that when you compare price risk management strategies that are available to chocolate companies versus cocoa farmers or cocoa aggregating organizations, we're looking at a lot more sophisticated strategies on the chocolate side. And the companies have used all of them. I don't know that.
Well, I mean, I know certainly over the years, we're coming into Christmas now when people have talked about shrinkflation, you know, where the box of roses chocolates that you might have gotten in the past that you might be paying a different or relatively similar price to them, but there's a lot less in it. Can I also just to look a long ways ahead? I was looking at what was discussed at the European Cocoa Forum in Malta, and, you know, they did discuss about production levels in the Ivory Coast. They were saying it may disappear by... reduced by 35% by 2050. 25% of that due to climate change and 10% due to the cocoa swollen shoot virus. Now, this country generates 15 to 20% of its GDP from cocoa export revenues. I can't imagine that people are sitting down today thinking, well, what do we do post-cocoa? But where do you see the long-term direction of travel for the people who you're talking to or who you come across within your 21 years in the industry?
You know, I think it really depends on what kind of truly, literally cash injection the industry is willing to make or governments are willing to make into the world's largest cocoa growing economies. There's no doubt we're in a period of climate pressure on cocoa. Supply is challenged. I will never deny that, and I will never say that the stress that's on the trees leads to disease. Swollen shoot, as you mentioned, being really, really serious, constraint on cocoa supply in across the West African region. But I think we cannot forget about the fact that investment, if it is made, can do a lot to if not reverse that, then at least slow it down. Okay. And I think it just comes down to that. Like, where is the industry going to put its money? Where are governments going to put their money?
But the difference in what you're talking about is that the government isn't wealthy enough to put it into itself, so it needs to come from outside. It's intriguing to talk to you. Thank you so much indeed, Dr. Christy Leslie, founder and CEO of the African Cocoa Marketplace.
Thank you so much.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, why do some people think we've reached peak Ireland? If you like your Irish foreign and economic policy topped by a green jersey, this next piece might give you pause for thought. Last week, Policy Exchange, a UK think tank, published a paper called Peak Ireland that looked at Ireland's role in a world where President Trump's vision of America may make the US look at us with a slightly more critical eye, to put it mildly. I'm delighted that one of the report authors joins me now, Harry Halem, Senior Research Fellow at Policy Exchange. Welcome to Taking Stock. Now, I have so much to ask you about this 36-page report. I read every line of it, and it is really, really intriguing reading. But I do want to start off by highlighting, of course, Harry, this was written for a UK audience to learn the lessons about where Ireland may have gone right or maybe potentially going wrong. So could you just tell us about where did the inspiration for the report come from? And then I'm going to get right into the meat of it.
Of course, and very happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me. The report was inspired by the geopolitical shifts that we've seen internationally, both since January 2025, after the second inauguration of President Donald Trump, and previously in 2023 and 2024. Policy Exchange, in fact, published a paper of which I was a co-author on Irish foreign and security policy and its reference to the UK that picked on a variety of similar and related themes. That was part of a broader program of work that we were doing on national resilience, particularly focused on undersea cables. And what we found in that work was that the UK and Ireland did not have a proper way to think through the issues that they faced. And in turn, the UK had therefore serious vulnerabilities that it had to address strategically when it faced a hostile Russia and also threats from other states, potentially China and Iran, and non-state actors. This paper, following off of it, was specifically contextualized in the second Trump administration. Its objective was to try to get British policymakers, the British public, and of course, Irish policymakers and the Irish public to take very seriously the consequences of President Trump's vision for global economic order, its demands on the security structures in the UK and Europe and the Euro-Atlantic space, and what it might mean if we make the wrong choices in these critical junctures for our relationship with the United States.
Okay, now when you speak about the maritime, that came very later on in the report, and also the reference to Russia and China. So I'm going to get to that. But I want to start off with where you put the bulk of the start of the report. And I'm just going to take one line out of it and put it to you, because this really summarizes your key point when it comes to the US and the New World Order. You said Trump's administration conditional approach to foreign policy in which the economic benefits from a close relationship with the US are contingent on broader foreign policy and strategic alignment, of which you were pretty scathing about the way in which Ireland is performing.
Yes, in fact, yes. And unfortunately, the evidence quite clearly bears that out. This is true both in economic contexts and in broader strategic contexts. Economically, the Irish model, as we put it in the paper, has relied upon creating a shelter tax status for a number of international companies, despite Ireland's EU membership. That has particularly attracted American multinationals, pharmaceutical companies, tech companies, etc. This has, of course, accrued significant revenue benefits to Ireland over the past 10 to 15 years, but is directly contradictory to the Trump administration's desire to reshore elements of manufacturing, reshore significant elements of the American supply chain, and more broadly, get a handle on where money is coming from and where it is going to for crucial American industries.
Okay,
Ireland is therefore stuck directly in the crosshairs.
Okay, right. And I take that. But there's a difference between a government like in the US saying we want more of you home and the way in which companies are motivated to do that. I'll just to delve into something else that you mentioned. You said if the US was to reshore the tax companies from these companies, and they were the companies that were particularly generating a lot of our corporation tax, you said it would recoup around about $26 billion per year using the existing flat rate tax of 21%. And you said from 2014 to 2021, the value of intangible assets in the Republic of Ireland nearly tripled. And you, again, you gave the numbers $400 billion to about a trillion. However, Trump might want them home, but they're incentivized to be in Ireland, not just because of, we'll say, the tax, and I want to get to that, but also because, just like you say, the access to the EU, the talent pipeline, the talent pool, and so on. Particularly when we look at GILTI, which is the Global Intangible Low Taxed Income, the permanent rate of that is 14% in the US. So the reality is that Trump might want them home, but they're incentivized to be here. So why, like, it seemed to be a pretty crude number to say, well, if they were to move back, there'd be an extra $26 billion. There's a lot of ifs in that.
Of course, international economics and international trade are always variable. But equally, we cannot deny that the Trump administration is using levers and applying pressure in a way that we've never seen the United States use levers and apply pressure before in a coordinated fashion beyond Irish macroeconomic issues and beyond EU macro per se to incentivize companies to strongly consider reshoring in part and in whole.
But therefore, also,
we can't consider simple considerations of economic and tax arbitrage like we usually would under normal market conditions.
Okay, but the thing is that what a lot of companies have said is that we are going to commit to investing enormous amounts, and like any of the companies you mentioned in the report have been coming out and saying we're going to put a lot more money into the US. That seems to appease Trump, and an awful lot of that includes commitments that are already there. So there's politics and there's economics.
Of course, but in the end, the political elements of here are going to win out. Why are these decisions being driven? In the United States, they're being driven, again, by an American administration that has strategically decided to take these steps. These steps are going to be taken in various ways over the next at least 3 years. And depending on who wins in 2028, we can see a radicalization and an intensification of these measures. Therefore, it's eminently prudent to anticipate a variety of incentives being deployed, as we outline in our paper, including those that are not yet deployed, to attract, induce, and compel companies to move and forego, in certain senses, EU market access on the one side, move to the United States. And in turn, of course, we need to remember that the European Union and the United States, independently of Ireland, have engaged in a structured negotiation process where quite consistently the EU has had a weaker hand. This, over time, is going to erode, in our view at least, the Irish negotiating position and its ability to attract and keep this kind of capital in country. The point for the UK audience, of course, as you mentioned, this paper was written for British audiences from London, is we need to be very careful to not get trapped in the seams. That is the key risk, of course, that faces Irish audiences and Irish policymakers. We see seams opening up in the global economy, friction points that are occurring, and Ireland is positioned, unfortunately, to get sucked straight into them with no real way to hedge and no real way to maintain flexibility without drastic course correction.
Well, let's now move on to security, because that is a very significant part of this report, but you're highlighting how it's a very weak point in not just in what it's spending, but actually how it's porous. And I'm using that word from your report. Now, you say the Republic of Ireland is a security freeloader, spending barely over 0.2% of GDP on defence. And you pointed out as well that new spending commitments in terms of defence are paltry.
Yes. And if we compare, in fact, Ireland to other neutrals in Europe, Switzerland and Austria, Ireland spends significantly less, not simply on core defense as well, but if we include intelligence capacity, cybersecurity, et cetera. Irish spending is nowhere near that of other relevant neutrals, Austria and Switzerland. The result is that de facto, Ireland must free ride off of the United Kingdom security guarantees and NATO more broadly, which necessarily implicates the United States. This is quite directly problematic in a geopolitical situation where the United States, the United Kingdom, and NATO allies must all confront specifically a revanchist Russia that means us a great deal of harm, and also other hostile powers, particularly state threats and also non-state actors.
Well, let's go to Russia then. I think your point here, and I really do encourage people to read the report, because I found this part and related to China and Iran as well, particularly interesting how you were saying the diplomatic efforts being made may actually present a porous challenge to Ireland. And of course, then the UK by association.
The UK by association and all of Europe by association, our entire Euro-Atlantic security community, on which Ireland relies and has always relied given its geography, history, and strategic interests. Now, when we think about diplomacy, typically, we assume that diplomats are doing the things that we would expect foreign services to do. They're negotiating trade deals, they're stamping visas at embassies and consulates, they're understanding how the politics of a country works, they're executing various cultural and other sorts of engagement with their host nations. That is in part true of the Russians, but the vast majority of the time, Russia will explicitly use its diplomatic services as cover for its foreign intelligence services. This is a long and well-established practice that the Russians have used since Soviet times. It's a practice that they deploy not simply in Ireland, but they also deploy in the United Kingdom, in Europe, and in the United States. Now, the big difference, of course, between the UK, Europe, and the United States on the one hand, and Ireland on the other, is the UK has taken steps to curtail Russian diplomatic presence because its security and intelligence services have identified the fact that Russian quote-unquote diplomats are actually intelligence agents attempting to cause the UK direct harm. You've seen a very similar trend in Europe. You've seen a very similar trend in the United States. Ireland is much more vulnerable simply because it does not have the resourcing based on government policy for an effective counterintelligence and security apparatus, which means that the system is more porous and that there is a much higher risk of penetration.
And I think that's tying back to your point about the 0.2% of GDP being spent on defence. That's not just this year, but due to the aggregation. I was interested as well, you seemed quite cynical of the jump in Irish-Chinese trade from 3.7 billion in 2014 to 25.3 billion in 2022, you quoted. So it seemed that you didn't think that that was arising from effective trade missions and the Irish entrepreneurial spirit and the rising market of the middle class in the Chinese. But instead, what you said was Chinese outward foreign direct investment serves as a means of acquiring technology, gaining insight into complex manufacturing and supply chain systems, and generally observing the industrial and financial systems of countries which are integrated into Western economic systems. Am I right in thinking then that you think the increase in Chinese trade is China simply wants to learn how we do business and how Europe itself does business so it can lever that to its own advantage?
So there are two aspects to the strategic threat that targeted Chinese trade expansion poses. On the one side, there's that element, and Ireland, of course, becomes an attractive target precisely because of the entrepreneurial elements in Irish national culture, the work that Irish diplomats do overseas to try to attract inbound investment. A Chinese trade official, who of course is going to have links with intelligence services, much like the Russian counterparts, is going to look at that and see an obvious opportunity to collect information about European practices, Irish practices, British practices, and broader Euro-Atlantic and Amero-Atlantic practices. On top of that, there's equally the risk that given the technology companies, the pharmaceutical companies, other critical companies that Ireland has hosted over the past 10, 15 plus years, the Chinese are not simply attempting to understand general trends, but they are specifically hoping to use an increase in economic presence and in financial presence to target those companies and use the information it develops on them for their own hostile ends. That can lead, that can include market capture and driving out Western actors from markets they're currently in, including Irish actors. Or it can also include other elements of intelligence operations that, once again, the Irish state is unfortunately not equipped to counter, given its inability to spend on defense and security.
Okay, but and there's one, and I'd like to explore that a bit more with you, but I'm right up against it with the clock, but I do want to quote this bit. It was round about page 32, it was right up at the end. You mentioned 3/4 of all the Northern Hemisphere underseas cables run through Irish territorial waters. That accounts for 97% to 99% of internet traffic running along them. And you highlighted how at times when they've come under attack, it has not been the Irish Defence Forces that has preserved the security of those waters, but outside.
Yes. Now, is there, of course, practical cooperation on an institutional level when incidents occur between Irish authorities and not simply British authorities, but primarily British authorities, given the geography, and also other members of NATO, other European countries? Of course. But the reality is these critical undersea internet cables, of which the overwhelming majority of internet traffic passes, it is impossible to replicate that traffic from space or by other means.
I really want to thank you for coming in and talking to us today, but also I have to say I found that report intriguing reading. Scary on occasion as well, but I certainly would encourage anybody to read it and critique it, just like I've had the chance as well to talk through it with you. Really appreciate, though, you coming on Taking Stock to discuss it with me. Harry Hallam, Senior Research Fellow at Policy Exchange, and the report is called Peak Ireland. Thanks so much indeed for being here.
Thank you very much.
Now, to give you the answer to my trivia question, I was in a city last week, which is the first ever city incorporated in Canada. So it's Canada's oldest city. It has reversing rapids where the river flows backwards due to the world's highest tides. And this is a giveaway clue. It's named after a river that shares its name with the producer of this show and presenter of Screen Time here on News Talk. The city is, of course, called St. John in New Brunswick. I wonder whether he knows that there is a city named in his honour. But that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan A. Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Next week on the show, we'll be looking at the economics of cruise ships. And I will just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And wherever you do go, make sure to subscribe to the show when you're there. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. You see what I did there? And on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I'm so delighted to be back here with you and already looking forward to chatting to you next week. Have a great day.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.